Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, and I'm joined today by James Johnson, our Chief of Chaplains, and today I'm privileged to introduce Brett Durbin, who is on our chaplaincy team, but he also is involved in connecting and building networks with our church partners and others in the community. And so I'm glad to have you with us today, Brett.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And our topic for today is a timely topic because our nation right now had some events that have brought this, I think, to everyone's attention. How should Christians respond to evil? I think it's timely, guys.
Absolutely.
Maybe we should start this conversation with what is evil? Mm. I mean, if we're going to respond to it, maybe we should have a definition of what it is. What is evil?
Well, the way I usually, you know, share it and discuss it is anything that we do that is in rebellion to God, his design laws, and his view of what should be done in what we call morality. What's the right way to act and live and treat each other? So when we do things God's way, we're in alignment with him. But when we rebel against that, that's where evil starts, is these selfish desires that we all have to push up against that and do things differently than his way.
Did you have a thought on that at all, Brett?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great definition. You know, I think anything that goes against, you know, who it is God created us to be is really by definition evil. It's something that is against God. It's opposed to God. But I do think it also can wear a lot of faces. You know, I mean, we can see evil as a person, someone who does a formidable act against us, you know, or it can be a system. It can be something within us. It can be our own personal sin. Mm-hmm.
So I do not disagree at all with what you said. In fact, I agree with it. But the way we're saying it seems to me leaves a wide open door for evil to move forward. Mm-hmm. For instance, anything that is not in harmony with God, God's will, God's design, which God?
Mm. Yeah.
Are we dealing with Jesus Christ, who, if you see me, you've seen the Father? Is that the same as the Islamic God? Is that the same as the God of the people who are Hindu and on and on the question goes. So they could take that same definition, and in their view, you know, evil is if you look at the Aztecs, evil would be not offering the child sacrifice.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the definition I don't disagree with, if we all agree on who God is, his methods, his principles, but we don't all agree on that. So it seems to me that definition still is not going to bring a clarity on how do we respond to evil, because isn't it true that many of the atrocities done in human history have been done in the name of God for the purpose of putting down evil?
Yes.
But we look at that and go, they were evil. Okay? So your definition is not wrong, but it doesn't seem like it's precise enough to actually help us clarify what evil is, because I would suspect those people burning people at the stake in the Dark Ages church did not think they were doing evil. In fact, the scribes and Pharisees who crucified Christ were just trying to uphold the principles of the Bible. And I doubt if you went to them, do you think you're doing good or evil right now?
Mm.
They would have said, we're doing good. This is a heretic. We have to destroy heresy. So in our society, again, back to the question, you know, how do we respond to evil? Is there any way we can hone it down to it's not wrong,
Brian,
but how do we get the ambiguity out when there's so many different pictures of God? And
well, I mean, you know, from the Christian perspective, I guess we could hone that in even more and, you know, say, what did Jesus do? You know, when we look at Jesus, we see the right way to live. How did Jesus treat people? How did he respond to the way people treated him? And, you know, how did he exist in as a, you know, human being in this fallen world? How did he live and treat people and respond to obedience to God and things like that?
So I mean, of course, Jesus is the touchstone for the Christian. How do you communicate that to the what? How many people currently in the world are Christian?
Right.
One third? Is it one third?
Yeah, a little over, yeah.
Yeah. So two thirds of the world would not accept that.
That's right.
But they would still want to, most people in the world, if you ask them, I think it's true, would want to stop evil.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever their definition is, most people are not wanting to be promoters of evil. They want to stop evil. We look in our society today with the big divisions happening. The people on the one side are wanting to stop the people on the other side, and both sides are wanting to stop evil they see in the other side. Is that not true?
Yeah, I think also, you know, if you look at even on a global standpoint, you know, a lot of Muslims that I worked with overseas and people from different religions, most of them actually did respect Jesus. They knew who he was and they saw him as a moral leader. So it's almost like there's some type of common ground you can find just on a moral character. They saw him as a great teacher. You know, obviously we see him as our Lord and Savior, you know, but they would see him as this moral leader. So is there some kind of common ground when we start talking about evil based on how Jesus taught? Did he teach it in a certain way, saying, well, these things that are immoral or against my Father's will is what evil is, you know? And so I don't know if there's a way that that can cross some of those barriers with what you're asking, you know?
Well, didn't Jesus have very similar conversations with the religious leaders in his day?
Yeah.
Okay. You have heard it was said, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. I say, turn the other cheek.
Right.
You have heard that it was said, and I say, you've heard that it was said, you know, those who commit adultery, well, I say, if you look lustfully at a woman, the woman caught in adultery, they said to him, the law says we should stone her. What do you say? And so my point is, they're looking to Jesus, and he is a heretic. He is actually not following the law. He is rebelling against the written code, not doing what it said. And thus, they called him a heretic. They actually said when he was doing some of this, are we not right to say you have a demon?
Was he more calling out their interpretation of the law?
But this is back to my point, okay? So even to his own culture in his day,
yeah.
Okay, you know, I agree with you because, of course, I believe Jesus is the embodiment of the Godhead, and, mm-hmm. and you see the truth lived out in him. I agree completely, but I'm asking, do we have a definition of evil that actually would be agreed upon across cultures? And I think there is. And in fact, there's been studies that looked at this. And the definition of evil that essentially every culture agrees upon is the exploitation of other people for your own benefit. That's a definition that everybody agrees. To exploit somebody. And you know, exploitation is take advantage of, lie, cheat, exploit, hurt, dominate, abuse, not for any blessing, just for your own advantage. Every culture, you know, they have their different standards of their own norms. But if you look functionally, operationally, evil in every culture is human exploitation of others. Mm-hmm. And that would be what you said. I don't know if you realize you said it, but mm-hmm. you said it. Selfishness.
Yes.
Which is antagonistic to love, which goes right back to the truth of God is love. And what Jesus revealed in self-sacrificial service, he did not think equality with God was something to be grasped, but humbled himself all the way to the cross and gave himself for others, which is selfless. So it's all true what you said, but it seems that we have to get to an operational definition.
Sure, we have to hone it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so with that definition, exploitation of others for personal advantage, is there any disagreement with that? Do you think that becomes operational? People can get their mind around that idea. It's evil when you take actions that are designed to hurt and harm another for your own benefit.
I think the only time we bump into a struggle with that is when, and this is, you know, we're starting to see a shift away from it as people are interacting with it and finding that it doesn't actually hold water morally and ethically. But, you know, in the 1920s, when we took God out of our schools and started teaching Darwinian evolution, people are taught, hey, the survival of the fittest. If I can get rid of the weaker, you know, whatever that weaker is, a weaker person, a weaker, you know, way of doing things, that the strong has to survive in order for humanity to get better, then if that person is weak enough that I can take advantage of them to exploit them, some people might actually interpret that as being a good thing if it actually promotes the betterment of the species of humanity.
Yeah, but see, that's not for your personal advantage. See, that would be the argument you made mm-hmm. would still not be in contradiction to what I said. Because the argument you made was for the species advantage, not personal advantage.
Okay.
It was for the society, for our larger need. Mm-hmm. So that actually
Of course, it's still wrong. We would reject it.
Right.
But the argument being made there is an altruistic need for the betterment of society and other people, not for oneself.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess you could extrapolate that down to the individual level for me to say, wow, if I'm living in a society where I'm trying to be stronger than my neighbor, well, if my neighbor can, you know, I can enslave them and make them work for me because I'm stronger than them. Well, then that's something I do selfishly for myself. I'm exploiting them. But the ultimate goal would be, you can parse that out, I guess.
Yeah. So again, though, even in societies around the world that don't believe in the Bible, in their culture, mm-hmm. they still recognize exploitation of others for own advantages.
Oh, I don't disagree with you. I was just presenting a worldview that might be in conflict with that.
But that's my point to mm-hmm. you. In the world where that philosophy dominates, they still recognize exploitation of others as evil. Yeah, they don't actually validate and part of the world where God is not part of the society. Well, Western Europe, where basically, you know, it's a godless evolutionary mm-hmm. mindset now. They don't actually validate going to your neighbor with a gun or a knife and taking their property from them because you're stronger, or enslaving children. They're against that stuff. They call that evil, but not from a biblical worldview, but because it's exploitative of others. They have some sense of morality, which as a Christian we would say, because there is a actual God, mm-hmm. and that's where that standard comes from. So it doesn't come from their philosophy, but they're still operating on it. So they would actually agree exploiting of others is evil, even with that. And it's a cognitive dissonance. You're pointing out a cognitive dissonance. It doesn't fit with their philosophy.
Right.
But in their culture, they still recognize it.
Oh, yeah. And we saw that play out at the end of World War II in the Nuremberg trials. Like what, you know, Nazi Germany did was legal to, you know, to attempt genocide and to kill millions of people, not just the Jews, but many others they considered, you know, to not be part of what they wanted to create their pure race. But when they were put on trial, that was what the judges had to appeal to, a higher level of morality. Like you're saying, that they recognized that even though it was legal in Germany to do those things and that the government, you know, made laws that encouraged it and promoted it, but they even recognized that that went against that innate moral law that you're mentioning. Yeah.
So how's that related to our question today of how should a Christian respond to evil? Because weren't the Nazis Christians? They used Martin Luther's writing to support their agenda.
I guess it would, yeah, depend on maybe closer ideas, but same idea, yeah.
So you know, do we accept the definition that evil is the exploitation and abuse of others for your own advantage?
One question I did have on that, just thinking about different cultures, would a culture with a caste system, would they not see that as exploiting others? Like if you have someone who, you know, hey, because of your situation, you're down here, but I'm up here, would that be still exploiting the people below you? I mean, from our perspective, I think it would be, but are they not seeing it that way?
So they would have within their culture, again, that's what I said, within their culture, there are different standards of what is exploitive and what is not. But when you cross whatever those standards of evil in there, you will see the dynamic is there.
Yeah, like they earned that position, so to speak.
Yes, that's their karma. Yeah. But then within that structure of their karma or their just deserts from, you know, whatever the forces of reality are, to take advantage and exploit beyond what the culture norms are, mm-hmm. becomes evil.
Right.
So that underlying principle, we would then, argue from a Christian perspective, because we have a value of every person is created in the image of God and mm-hmm. so forth, that itself is exploitive. They don't see it that way. Because they don't have the same understanding of the equality of all human beings. They have a different, but within that culture, they would still see, you know, child molestation and this type of thing, stealing from somebody of the same caste, at least. I don't know how it works. I don't know if about a culture, whether it's not evil to steal from a lower caste or not. I suspect it would still probably be viewed as evil. But I don't know enough to say. But the function of whatever they term an evil, you'll see functionally has an exploitation of others for your advantage.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay? And so then with that in mind, what's the Christian response? What do we see happening? Do we see evil on the rise in the world?
I definitely think we see exposure to it rising. You know, we can debate whether technology, like, you know, the big discussion around things like the atom bomb and, you know, modern warfare and that kind of thing. And that's a little bit of a different discussion. But we definitely have a lot more exposure to it. You know, when we had the technological revolution of the 1890s really started bringing, you know, not just, I get a report every few weeks or months from something across the world that is you know, we began to participate in these global conflicts that people wanted to know what's going on in the world, and journalism, technology, radio, movies, television. We get live stream news 24 hours a day. And I think, you know, one of the things that was pretty, I don't know, maybe at least revolutionary as far as the way we understand it, that when the war in Ukraine kicked off, that they were saying this was the first conflict that's actually being live streamed, that these people are putting on, they're going on Twitter, they're going on Instagram, they're going on these social media feeds, and they're showing the conflict live.
So I'm trying to understand where we're going. You're losing me.
I'm saying that the exposure to evil is definitely greater, even if evil is not necessarily greater in the world. We're seeing it more.
So are you saying that the media is evil?
I'm saying they're exposing us to the reality of evil that, you know, prior to, you know, 24 round the clock global news broadcasts, even before, like, you know, watching the films during World War One and World War II that people could go into the movie theater and see, a lot of people in the world were very isolated. And, you know, America hasn't had a, you know, conflict come to our nation actually on our soil in, you know, a very long time. So many people have grown up in our part of the world very oblivious to a lot of the evils in the world. And so when we have some of the things that we see in recent events and it's being plastered everywhere on every screen and every feed, we're definitely getting a much greater exposure to it. I'm not saying that, you know, necessarily evil has not been there, and it's hard to say if it's on the rise or if it's just more exposure to it. Of the reality of it, it's always been there, you know, obviously since Cain, you know, killed his brother. But they murdered him. But it's this idea of now we see it more, and so we're more aware of it.
And I disagree.
Okay.
I disagree. I do think it's more in our public eye because of media. But I actually think the world is polarizing. I think we're moving towards the final events before Christ's return, very much like Christ said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. And the days of Noah is violence and violence all the time. There's only one righteous person left on the earth. The Bible talks about the final generation. There'll be a remnant of righteous people, but the vast majority of the world, the whole world, wanders after the whatever that beast is. We don't have to get into it, but the whole world goes in a direction other than righteousness. They go in an evil direction. So I think it's more than just we're seeing it. I think we're experiencing a rise of fear-based, self-protective actions. And we're seeing lots of activities that are designed to inflame fear in people to get them to prioritize their well-being over their neighbors. And so when we talk about evil, in my view, the worst evil is not the child predator, the murderer, the warmonger. There's really very few people that look at that and go, oh, that's good. No, that's obvious evil. Everybody sees that and goes, that's bad. That's bad stuff. Okay, the evil that is the true insidious evil is the evil that masquerades in our societies as righteous, that people buy into, that it's good to do this is the right thing to do, and what they're actually doing is evil. Dark Ages example, most people would not disagree today, but it was good and righteous to burn people and heretics at the stake. It was good in Salem to burn witches at the stake. This was righteous behavior. It was evil, okay? It was evil, and what it made it most evil is because people viewed it as righteous, okay? So my view is that there's a propaganda machine going on in the world that is conditioning people's hearts and minds to actually participate in evil while they think it's good. And this is what I think is actually what we're setting up for and what we're seeing today, the rise of evil, and what I see. And this is why we want to have this conversation. What is the right Christian response? Mm-hmm. What is the right Christian? How do we respond when real evil is done? Because I see Satan's strategy historically is always to get his people to do something bad, harmful to another group, and get that group to recognize that's bad and harmful and respond to try to make it right, to do rightness, or if you want to use Latin, justice, the just and right thing, okay? To do justice, to make it right, to put it right by exercising his methods, not God's methods. So our goal is a righteous goal. It was a righteous goal for Christians in the Dark Ages to try to convert people to Jesus. It was an unrighteous method to coerce and burn them at the stake, okay? It was an unrighteous method to go on crusades, okay? These methods are bad. But maybe the goal is, well, I want to serve God. Yeah, good goal. And you see this in religions across the world. In jihads that happen. Why are they doing it? Because they don't believe in their God? Because they don't want to promote him? They don't want to be righteous? They don't want to do what they think is justice? Or they're doing what they think is justice and they fly planes into buildings?
Yeah.
And so this is what I see happening. And what I want to maybe help us talk about is how can the Christian, when real injustice happens, like an innocent person at a college event gets shot in the neck, an injustice, a wrong, an evil happens, how can a Christian respond in a way that's actually consistent with Jesus Christ and not let that inflame them to try to seek to do justice by using the very methods that the other side is using?
Mm-hmm.
And do you think I'm just setting up a false argument? You think that's a real strategy of the devil? Do evil to good people to inflame in them the desire to do right, but let's trick them into using my methods to try to make it right. For instance, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. You knock my eye out, so now I have a right to hurt you.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I think even kind of piggybacking what you said a second ago, just about our exposure to it, I think the fact that we have just this 24-hour access to this where, you know, my kids, I have a couple of kids in youth group, their entire youth group had seen the actual video of him getting shot in the neck within hours. And so everyone that came to youth group on Wednesday night had already seen this. And so there was a whole different level of how do we even deal with this, because everyone saw it, you know? So it wasn't just, hey, I heard that something happened, some guy got shot. I saw it. I visibly saw this go down. And you have all these people not knowing what to do with that information, because most people, even if they've seen movies or done video games, is not the same as when you see someone. And then also you look at that person and say, this was someone who really at least stood on, you know, his morals and on, you know, I think most of us would agree on Christian character. You know, it hits different, you know, and so how we respond to that and even how we talk to young people about that. I talked to several youth pastors because it was a Wednesday. So all these Wednesday night things were going on and they were having to just shut down what they were doing just to have a conversation and say, hey, we need to talk about this because it is a big deal.
No, I like what you said there. Are you picking up any threads of how people are, maybe the word tempted because isn't the right word, because that could imply I mean sin. I don't mean sin. I mean the inclination as they've seen it on the video. Are you picking up any threads on the inclination of how people are instinctually or you know, being drawn to respond? Any sense of a consensus of response that seems to be swelling?
Oh, sure.
You know, what are we hearing?
You know, because when we see injustice like this, our natural response is we're motivated to do something. We just have this desire. We want to do something about it. And if we're not careful, we can fall into the same three categories of people that existed during the time of Jesus. That Jesus, when he taught the Sermon on the Mount, giving his yoke as a rabbi, as a teacher, was, you know, advocating a different way of doing things from those three major responses. The one that we're very used to is the legalistic religious leader.
Yeah, but I'm asking, you said these young people saw it. I'm really asking, are we hearing a response from people that they're being tempted?
Oh, sure. I mean, the what I was working towards was this idea of, you know, one of those three groups in Jesus' time was the zealots. They saw the evil and they were responding with, we need to take action militarily, physically, with violence. We need to actually create a system that mirrors what the Romans are doing to us. So if the Romans can take us over with military force, we need to create a response to start bringing our version in a system. So like one of the things that we're seeing in America that mirrors that is the rise of Christian nationalism. That we need to get involved in the government. We need to make America a Christian nation, and we need to start making laws that keep people from being able to do these things using a semblance of Christianity that looks and feels right, but it's a counterfeit, because God's kingdom doesn't come with force and violence. That's one of the things that Jesus was saying in the Sermon on the Mount is, you know, we've got to do things. My way is different. The kingdom is different from earthly kingdoms.
Well, like I said to Pilate,
yeah,
my kingdom's not this way. If it were,
right, my people would fight for me. Yes.
Yes. So they're validating what you're saying, right. that Jesus, you know, would not have taken that approach.
Right.
Okay, keep
going. But we're being radicalized maybe is a strong word, but it definitely is getting the idea of radicalization is where we get so used to a concept that what used to be unthinkable is now thinkable. Oh, we need to become a movement, a group of people that instills a version of Christianity that is so in tune with the way our government works. It's part of the fabric of our government. It infuses our lawmaking models, and we start taking over a form of Christianity that actually is not the one that Jesus advocated.
Let me pause you there and go back to Brett. Brett, you said these young people saw this.
Yeah.
They were, I suspect, traumatized in a certain way, shocked at least.
Yeah.
Stunned, shocked.
Yeah.
Did they have a sense of this is not right, a sense of outrage?
They did. I think there was one thing that I saw from it was, you know, we always ask that question, are all of our youth being just numbed, you know, to violence because of how much violence is in movies and video games, all these things. And there was not a numb response. It was, this was real. And they saw someone die in front of them and that a lot of them looked up to. A lot of them actually saw this, at least in the groups that I was coming from. Mm-hmm. And so it hit really hard. And I think there was a lot of emotion, and there was anger. There was sadness. There was a sense of loss, you know, and I can even say I myself, like, I hadn't heard about it. I had been in meetings all afternoon. My college age son shoots me a text and says, hey, don't open this around kids. Did you hear about what happened to Charlie Kirk? And I thought, oh my gosh. And it hit me. It was sad. It saddened me just, you know, and I'm.
So, yes. And I purposely have made the choice. I don't want to see that video.
Yeah.
I don't want to. There's no blessing in actually seeing what happened to his body when the bullet struck him. There's no blessing in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we don't need to see that. That will actually cause a lot of distress to see that. So I purposely didn't look at those videos, and I don't recommend people do. You don't have to look at that to process this. But you're dealing with kids who saw it.
Yeah.
Immediately what popped into my mind, and they're having a reaction. And I think they could be tempted and could be, as they're emotional, vulnerable to perhaps people who want a Christian nationalism type of approach. Let's use the U.S. government and the government laws to legally, we don't want to go out and start a civil war. We don't want to go out and use our own gun violence or anything like this. We want to do this legally. Let's use the government passed laws to go out and nationalize and make legal and or, you know, take wealth, take power, take property in a legal way from those who would be behind this philosophy and these types of behaviors. I think there would be support for that. They would be vulnerable to being drawn into that. My question, though, is when you said they saw it personally, they saw, immediately popped into my mind, in the New Testament, there's only one gospel writer who saw Jesus being crucified. They all ran, except one. One stood by and witnessed. Now you say, this was graphic. It was horrible for them to see the shooting. Imagine if you were there watching the crucifixion of Christ in person. That would be actually horrible. And I suspect not that there's any good, you know, murder. Jesus was murdered on the cross. But his suffering was much more than an instant, you know, shot in the neck. I mean, and I'm not diminishing what happened here. Please don't hear that. But it would be more horrible to have to watch that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was drawn out.
Yeah, drawn. This is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Terrible.
It was gruesome. Yeah.
Torture, abuse. But John watched it. And read the Gospel of John compared to the other three. They all have truth, but there's a different quality.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the quality? When you see John, who watched Jesus die on the cross, what was John's response? Nationalism? No. Love.
He was his friend.
Love your enemies.
Yeah, he stood.
Pray for those who abuse you.
Mm-hmm.
Turn the other cheek. It didn't go the direction of we need to get, now what we need to do after this injustice, we need to appeal to Caesar and have Pilate impeached and put in a new governor who is friendly to the followers of Jesus, and we need to pass laws to take the power from the Sanhedrin, and we need to establish a Christian, you know, base of moral authority in the government. Did you see the apostles seeking to get new senators in Rome? And did you see it go that direction?
No.
But that form of government, a representative government, was on Earth at that time. The Roman government had Senate, and they could have appealed for a new governor, and that happened frequently. Governors were replaced. I didn't see it go that direction at all. And this is the point that I'm making here, that I think, you know, the Christian response to evil is not through human governments. My kingdom is not this world. Mm-hmm. Can you advance love, trust, loyalty, friendship through legislation and law enforcement?
No. Otherwise, whenever a law enforcement officer pulled up behind me, I would be excited to see them rather than, frankly, always being a little scared.
No, this is I think part of the trap of evil.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, one of Satan's strategies. He will incite people who are vulnerable to his spirit of fear and selfishness, inflame them to, and what we're hearing about the shooter, you can see it was a spirit of fear and selfishness.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think most people, if you look at, you know, all those things you just listed, you know, legislation, government, that whole structure, do we see, you know, when we look at what freedom is, you know, American freedom, and does it give you the framework to then carry out the things that we just talked about, love, peace, walk as Jesus, because we have the freedom to do that? Is that framework, does it get kind of blurred into what we see as Christianity or as a way of following God? So we need to make sure that these laws are what they are, so that way we can continue carrying out the gospel. We can continue spreading the gospel, you know, because, I mean, the biggest missions, you know, movement in history came out of this country, really. I mean, in terms of at least mass exposure.
I mean, No. So I think what you're describing is an age-old question. Where's the balance between what you might call imposed laws, human governments, and God's kingdom, creator laws, design laws, how reality works? And my understanding, and you find this both in the Old Testament and in Romans chapter 13, where in a world of sin, dealing with corrupt, unconverted, unrighteous, self-centered, evil-hearted people who will take advantage and exploit others, there is a place for imposed laws with external enforcement for restraining the person who would do evil. You can do that. You can actually lock up a pedophile. You can lock up a murderer. You can do that. But you cannot actually advance love, loyalty, right heart, righteousness through external law and law enforcement. You can only restrain the evildoer, which brings a certain structure in order to society where then truth, freedom, and so forth. And, you know, John Adams famously said, founder of this country, that our form of government that they were setting up is only suitable for a religious and moral people. The freedoms that we were going to establish in our Constitution can only work in a society who have internalized a certain ethic and morality that they would not seek to exploit their neighbor. If you have a society that is amoral, that has no moral compass, that has no internalized sense of personal responsibility to be a good neighbor. If their morality is, I have a right to go into a store and shoplift because corporations are corrupt, because we live in a society of the colonialist and we've all been exploited, and so it's actually the right thing to do to go in mass shoplifting. If you live in a society like that, then a society where you don't have everything locked up in a cabinet, a free society where things are open on the shelf, doesn't work. Freedoms only work when you actually have people who have in them a certain moral, which is the new covenant, my law in your heart and mind. They have a desire. That I'm not saying they're flawless and perfect, but they have a desire. They want to be good people, good citizens, good neighbors. They don't want to take advantage. And when society decays, in which that people actually become evil in character, they actually have as a moral compass this mindset of it's right to take advantage of these people because these people are abusers and it's the right thing to do to steal from them and so forth and so on. Then you have to actually get more and more restrictive. We don't have the freedoms going into our airports we used to. Everything gets searched in ways because some people have done evil. In certain parts of our country, you go into the store and stuff is all locked up. You actually can't get anything in the store. You have to go up and ask for it because of so much shoplifting and stealing going on, because people don't have it in themselves anymore. And so there is a place for human government and human law to provide a societal structure to restrain the evildoers so that the gospel message, the truth about God, can go forward, convert hearts. And when hearts are converted, where you love your neighbor as yourself, and you love God with all your heart, you actually don't need a rule or external enforcement not to murder, not to steal, because you wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And people get confused on this all the time, and they conflate these two, and they think you can actually advance God's kingdom through law and law enforcement. No, you can only restrain evil, but you actually can't make people righteous that way. And if you look at communist countries like communist China, there's very little crime in most of their streets because they have a very strong external, you know, military government that police everything. And if you step out of line, that's, and you know, you're done. And but that doesn't mean that government brings righteous hearts. It means and it's not just righteous hearts and love that freedom requires. You know what else is freedom is required? Freedom. We require freedom to have the development of the image of God in people. If we don't have actually liberty to exercise our own thinking and our own decision making within the bounds of reason, then we become drones. We become mindless. We're constantly looking for someone who is an authority to tell us what we're supposed to think, do, and behave. And we just want to stay inside the lines that the authority has told us because we don't want to get zapped. We don't get in trouble. And we never develop. We never learn. And that's what happens in communist countries. And that actually is the goal. It's also the goal of the Dark Ages Church. The Dark Ages Church did not want their followers to actually be thinkers. They wanted them to be mindless drones who would continue to support the system, do what the priest says because the priest says it, not because you actually understand why you should do it. And it destroys the image of God in people. So there's a place in our society, in America, was set up with a structure to restrain the historic powers that would invade liberties, but also simultaneously providing a space with maximum freedoms for individual development and growth. That's why this country has thrived. Religious liberty and civil liberties were protected, and that's what made this country healthy. But evil comes in and takes advantage of liberty, and then people respond to the evil by wanting to take more and more liberties away, make us feel safe. And that is where I'm going with, hopefully, with this conversation. We will recognize as Christians, you actually cannot get, you can't advance the kingdom of God by taking freedoms to make yourself feel safe. Can you? I mean, if you disagree with that, argue that. Say, no, we can. Well, only within broad limits you can restrain in a very broad way, but you actually can't you know, put people in boxes.
Well, and we see this in the you know, penal system that we've created. You know, the word penal and repent have the same root word. It's supposed to create a heart change. You're supposed to have a sorrow for what you did, and you're supposed to repent and change the way you think and act. But we see that rehabilitation, by and large, fails in our penal system. Why? Because they're trying to force it on them by removing liberty, and it doesn't do that. You know, you can modify behavior, you can restrain certain actions, but you can't change somebody's heart through force. It has to be freely chosen. And of course, we know the only way to truly have a transformed heart and mind is for the Holy Spirit to do it. But even that's where the choice comes in, where we choose to partner with God and do things His way and receive
His. What are the big principles or methods or motives or elements that God and the Holy Spirit use to bring people? There's two big ones, the two big threads, if you will. Truth and love, right? Truth and love. What's it say in Romans? That the kindness of God leads us to
repentance.
Mm-hmm. It you know, on the cross, when he's, again, back to that, your young people witnessed this. John witnessed. The thief on the cross witnessed. And what did they witness Jesus doing? John, go out and recruit our buddies. This is an act of injustice. This is an abuse of power. It is unright what they're doing to me. They have no right to treat me this way. Go out, start a militia, get our people, train them up. Peter has the first sword. Go ahead and get some more. Okay, is that what Jesus did?
Father, forgive them. They know not what they do.
And what did the thief do when he saw that? The one thief said, now remember me. Hey, wow. Unbelievable.
Well, and even the centurion, you know, said this truly was the Son of God because he saw what happened on the cross.
And this is the big challenge as we face evil. The big challenge as we face evil. What about the martyrs in the arena?
Mm-hmm.
How did the gospel spread so rapidly in that first century? And it did. The whole Roman Empire is being taken over by the gospel of Jesus Christ through legislation, through new senators, new governors, or military. No, none of that. It was the people who actually loved like Jesus
mm-hmm.
were being persecuted, and they were blessing their persecutors. And it was blowing, because they were, you understand what the Bible says in Hebrews 2:14, that Christ took upon himself human flesh, that by his death he might destroy him, holds the power of death, and free those who live all their life enslaved by the fear of death. Mm-hmm. The whole world lives in fear of death. Those martyrs were not afraid. Revelation chapter 12, verse 11, describing the generation that sees Jesus come, says, these are they who do not love their life so much as to shrink from death. Something has changed where that natural survival drive you talked about earlier that drives us, that fear to hurt somebody, protect self, they actually love God and others, that they don't love their life so much. They would give their life for others. Greater love is no man than to give his life for a friend. This is a response that will transform and witness. Just like, but what I'm afraid of for the Christian community is that they're going to be tempted with the worldly judicial response to believe that the right and just thing to do is to use might and power to put down the evil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think you actually hit on something with the penal system. You know, interestingly, if you look at correctional rehabilitation, prison fellowship, Kairos, these faith-based programs, their rate of success and how much lower their recidivism rate is it's drastic. It's not just a little bit. I mean, it's very, very, blatantly better in terms of their outcomes.
Why?
Then God is involved. But they want it. They have a change of heart.
Say that last part again.
They have a change of heart. They want you, like you said, if it's forced on you, if it's just, here's your rules, you're in this box, you're not going to really change. It's like if you have an encounter with the living God, if you have a heart change, you are going to change at some level. Does that mean you're never going to mess
up?
But can you
describe the heart change though? What would you say elementally is how their heart changed in exactly that way? They just made a verbal declaration of a belief in God. Is that all that happened?
They experienced the Holy Spirit and the grace of God.
Yeah, I agree with you, but yeah. I want functionally, can you describe the elemental change that happened in their heart?
We put others above ourselves.
Love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, love.
This love.
They were, prior to the conversion, fear-driven out to get for self and protect self because they're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And the biblical conversion is described in a variety of ways, but one is we die to the old life, or we surrender the old life, or we're reborn with a new life. In other words, that heart change you're describing, wouldn't it be that they are no longer primarily driven, not tempted, driven by that fear and need to advance self, and now they're driven by a love for God and a desire to bless others.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your very example of, all of the martyrs, in the first century, especially the ones who people knew were the ones who are claiming Jesus rose from the dead, their fear is gone. They were afraid, right? We knew they were afraid at first, but something shifted them. I mean, that's that big argument of the resurrection. It's kind of a strong one, mm-hmm. is that all of these people had lost all fear of death. And I mean, across the board, it was not one of them really, flinched as far as we know. And they knew the truth of who Jesus was. They knew what true love was. They saw what he did.
And using the word know in that intimate sense, not cognitive knew,
yeah.
they experienced it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was knowing in their heart and experiencing it in a way that, I mean, no other group got to after them because they were there. They were actually able to be a part of it, but that just launched the church in a way that people saw that. I mean, you see a huge group of people that are just completely unafraid of death. Well, for what reason? Well, we saw the truth. That's what.
And so tying this then, I love that. The evil versus the Christian response to evil You know, as soon as Adam and Eve sinned, they ran and hid because they were afraid.
Mm-hmm. Camouflage themselves, yeah.
And tried to make themselves look better with their leaves. Adam is trying to protect his own, you know, culpability by blaming Eve. Eve is trying to protect her own culpability by blaming the serpent. And then God, because God put the serpent there. So in other words, the change in spiritual motivation from love and trust to fear and selfishness drives evil behavior, fear and selfishness. We're born in sin, conceived in iniquity. We're born with coming into the world from Adam and Eve with this primary drive of insecurity, fear, and a need to watch out for self. That's why Jesus said in Nicodemus, you got to be born again. You got to be born again with a new spirit. And all the, you know, scriptures describe that Paul, it's no longer I that live, but Christ lives in me. Prior to his conversion at Damascus, he is using what method? The method of the state. He had legal authority to do what he was doing. He was going out and arresting those people who believed in Jesus and imprisoning them under legal authority, you know, a certain religious nationalism. Mm-hmm. But after his conversion, and that was driven by fear, but that fear led to a certain understanding of what righteousness is or zealous, that was using methods that were very exactly the opposite of the methods of God. That's Saul of Tarsus, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
But after his conversion, he has an entirely new spirit, entirely new method. And you read in like Romans, every person should be fully persuaded in their own mind, or in Ephesians, we present the truth in love, we lead people free. He doesn't use this method. I would give my life. I would gladly give my life. My fellow Jews might be converted. We find a motivational change from needing to protect self and use power over others to make compliance so that we can feel safe, toward I would actually surrender my life if it would help bless another.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm suggesting that what we're seeing happening in the world today, and the Bible uses that metaphor of Satan as the end of time, as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. A lion's roar does actually not cause injury. A lion's roar incites fear. Mm-hmm. That's right. It incites fear. And so what you were saying earlier about the messaging everywhere, this is part of what I believe is the roar of the enemy. Because that messaging that we're hearing in many, many channels of this world now is an amplification of be afraid, you're not safe, it's scary, you're going to be taken advantage of, you're going to be exploited, the whites are against the blacks are against the whites, the Europeans are against the Americans, and et cetera, the rich are against the poor, and it's constant, be afraid of this group, be afraid of that group, be afraid of this, be afraid of that, you won't get justice, you won't be watched out for, you've got to rise up, do you not feel that all the time?
Yeah.
Okay, and so this is the roar to divide. Mm-hmm. Satan is the divider. God's the uniter. We come into a unity inherent in our faith. And then to use the methods of force and coercion under law to promote what is viewed as justice, just like Saul of Tarsus, to promote what they think is healthy. And this is what I think, you know, what's the beast of Revelation rise to do? Whatever you think that beast is, it doesn't rise to do proclaimed evil. It doesn't rise up satanic worship cult centers. Everybody would see that for fraud. It rises to do justice, to make the world better, to stop evil. But you won't be able to buy or sell or save. It's going to use economic forces and coercion. It's going to control markets, take liberties, do this or else, a coercive threat, punishment, mm-hmm. to comply. I mean, is that not how it's going to functionally? Yeah. Going to work?
And I mean, if you even just look at, you know, the example you used with Charlie Kirk, what an interesting character to have taken out. I say that because you have, on one side, you have many people who thought he was going to end up being president. It was this strong voice in the Republican Party. It was very political. Then the other reality of him was he shared the gospel pretty much every time he would go out on campus and talk to students. And so you have this blending of, it's this political person, but he's also this very gospel-driven, I'm going to share about Jesus with everyone I possibly can person. And so then you have almost, it's all getting blended together in one pot. So it's this political figure, but he's also this religious figure. You know, it causes even more confusion, you know, and I think that's part of what we're seeing too, is just, it's a lot of people struggling through this. And,
no, I agree with you. Now, as we kind of wind this program up, how do Christians respond to evil? I'm going to share with you kind of my personal interpretation of a very confusing long Bible prophecy. I won't go through the long, but the overview of it. And I really want your honest, like, maybe you're off there, okay? because again, I don't claim any, you know, prophetic gift. I'm just a Bible student trying to understand. But I'd like to see if you see any resonance with this at all, and to see if there's any truth in it. And I wrote the first blog on this in 2020, and I wrote a follow-up in 2022. So this is something that's been out there for at least 5 years. But it has to do with the prophecy of Daniel 11, the king of the north and the king of the south. It's a very long, complicated prophecy. But in the prophecy itself, it identifies king of the south as Egypt and king of the north as Babylon. And in Bible symbolism, you know, Egypt is represented Pharaoh, who is God that I should know him. Mm-hmm. And so I've interpreted based on this that this power of the king of the south represents the forces of Satan through history, who are godless in nature, who deny the God of the Bible, like Pharaoh, paganism, and then ultimately becomes, you know, evolutionism, you know, agnosticism, you know, communism, you know, humanism, scientism, all these different things that are completely godless in nature. These are King of the South forces. And there are three players in the prophecy: King of the South, King of the North, and the Beautiful Land. The Beautiful Land represents God's people. King of the North is represented by Babylon. You remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, after they come out of the fiery furnace, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon immediately passes a law proclaiming the God of Daniel, the true God, and anybody who says bad things about him should be killed and their home destroyed and their family killed. Immediately passing governmental law to enforce the honoring of the God of the Bible, what I call religious imperialism, which would be represented by Babylon and then later the Dark Ages church, who would use those state powers to force this belief. And so through history, I see these powers of both are Satan's in nature. Godlessness on one hand, a false religious imperialism using the methods of force and coercion to promote a proclaimed belief in the Bible or the God of the Bible, back and forth. And then you go all the way down through history. The last two movements are the king of the south, godlessness, attacks the king of the north, which is, you know, Western Christianity, which I see happening with Darwin and the Enlightenment. And for the last 250 years, we've seen the rise of the godless forces attacking Christianity in Western society, with ever-increasing in the schools, taking God out of the schools, denigration of Christian belief, evolutionism in most of the institutions of our culture, and ultimately ending up in wokeism and some of this extreme stuff we've seen. That's the second. And then the king of the north storms out against the king of the south, takes their wealth, takes their property, takes their power. And then Michael the prince stands up and the second coming happens. And so I'm seeing that the beautiful land represent God's people. And Satan has these two forces through history, always battling back and forth for the purpose of not getting them, because he's already got them. It's getting those people who really love God and really worship him in truth to be so agitated by one or the other, even so discouraged by the abuses of a Dark Ages church, which you saw happen. The Dark Ages church was not God's kingdom. But their abuses were so horrible, many people left the belief in God and became godless and joined the king of the south. And then you see the godless do outrageous things the last 250 years, ending up in this extreme wokeism that now is going to tempt people to leave God's principles that we're talking about and join with King of the North, a religious imperialism, to use the same coercive methods to abuse and destroy the King of the South. And the goal is that group in the middle. This is what I see playing out right now. And the true message for the end time people is don't join either one of those sides. Be loyal to Jesus Christ and love your enemies and pray for those and practice his methods. And anyway, what do you see any light in this? You think I'm like off base?
Well, it's always hard when we look at some of those things. And that's why I appreciate you, you know, sharing that, you know, it's interpretation that they're referring to literal events and literal people that existed to help them see the larger connection to God's ultimate plan. And so when we look at that, you know, whether it's specifically to our generation or maybe it's previous before, that the point still stays the same, that we do things God's way, that Jesus offered a way of doing. That's why early Christians weren't called Christians. They were called followers of the way. And so, you know, as we look at the situation that we're in right now, like you said, we have to be wary of the responses to either of those two things, of what godlessness is promoting a new form of godliness, like we talked about before, that has no power because it's not connected to doing things God's way.
Yeah. And do you have any thoughts on that, Bob?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, when you get into the, you know, prophecies of Daniel, it always, it's interesting to me, you know, but it's also, I would agree, you know, I think there was these literal examples that were being used to show a bigger picture and a future picture, you know, what is to come. I don't know if I would look at what's happening today as in comparison to, say, as you said, the Dark Ages. Is this just another big swing that we're going to see that's going to move that way and then it moves back again? You know, is that, it's almost like the cycles of, you know, whether it's weather or whatever, cultures. Are we just in a cycle that's moving in that direction to where we're heading towards like a really bad Dark Ages situation to where then you would, like you described, we would see people pull back out of that and they were just get sickened by that and it would swing the other way? I don't know. I can see where you're coming from 100%. I mean, I just don't know.
So this will tie this then into a next show. And the next show, let's talk about, do we still as Christians believe in the second coming of Christ? Let's talk about that on the next show. Because I think what you just said there actually to me segues, because if we believe in the second coming and we believe it's imminent, then that would mitigate the perpetual swing. Eventually, sure, it's going to come to an end.
Yeah.
Okay.
There is an end.
Yeah. But do we believe do we believe we're living in the generation that could be alive for Christ to come? Or do we believe that, no, it's another 2,000 years and it's going to keep this swinging back and forth? I mean, I think what you said there is legitimate. But if we have evidence or reason to believe, no, Christ is coming soon, then maybe there's not going to be another swing. It's going to be this and the Christ coming.
This is the swing.
Yeah. So that's a very fair thing. But let's tie that over to our next program. Let's talk about, you know, do we still believe in the second coming and why? And what's that?
Is that? Let's get it all figured out.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us today. And yes, we hope this show was helpful for you. Evil happens in this world. We've all been hurt by it. The trap of the devil is to take the hurts that we experience and cause us to want to respond in a way that is different from Jesus. And our goal is to take those hurts to Christ, ask for his presence, healing our hearts, and help us to respond as Jesus would to advance his kingdom, not the kingdom of this world. Thank you for joining us. Now, if you have questions, send those to questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.